Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what is the code economy and what does it have to do with the future of work? And first, why were CIA agents reading French philosophy? With us is Gabriel Rockhill. He's a professor of philosophy and political theory at Villanova University and directs the critical theory workshop at Sorbonne. His recent books include Counterhistory of the Present, Interventions in Contemporary Thought, and Radical History in the Politics of Art. Welcome to the Scholar Circle, Gabriel Rockhill. It's great to have you here with us.
Thank you.
So you've written this piece about the CIA's study of philosophy and use of culture, arguing that its agents recognize the power of theory and of culture. Let's start with that as the background. What exactly were CIA agents studying and why?
Well, one of the major concerns with the CIA, which is an organization that grew out of the OSS over the Second World War, was to consider and take seriously the ways in which culture and intellectual production has an impact on worldviews. And so from their very moment of instantiation, they were concerned with how they could shift an understanding of global politics from the immediate moment of the end of World War II, in which the United States had collaborated with the Soviet Union, meaning the leader of communism in the world, and transition from that moment to a redefinition of the very political landscape of the latter half of the 20th century. And in order to do that, they needed to take distance from the Soviet Union and from communism, their allies in the war, and redistribute things in such a way that they began then cultivating a leftist intellectual and cultural orientation that was no longer, or that's at least one of their goals, was no longer magnetized by the pole of the East and a hard communist politics, but instead started to drift to the center. And that this cultural and intellectual mode of warfare, that's the vocabulary that they use, psychological warfare, was a way of attempting to change the kind of ideological spectrum or the worldview of the general population, but with an insistence on the way in which culture and the intellectual world could serve that particular project. One of the reasons that this was important for political reasons is that the communists, of course, fought against the fascists in World War II, and that the CIA wanted to rewrite this history of the 1930s and 1940s by aligning communism on fascism, lumping them together under the category of totalitarianism, thereby delegitimating and discrediting a strong leftist position. And this could be communism, but it could be more generally, I would say, egalitarianism, anti-capitalism, anti-imperialism, and so forth. And so they saw in the world of culture and the sphere of intellectual production a realm in which they could undertake a very specific form of warfare that reoriented people's understanding of world history, meaning both the past and future possibilities.
So you based this on some documents that have been declassified. What were these exactly?
Well, there's a recent document from 1985 that details the ways in which the CIA had operatives based in France who were studying the intellectual drift of the intelligentsia from a hard left position of a radical egalitarian, anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist politics toward either more centrist positions in which they gave up on revolutionary politics and so radical social transformation, or an explicit right-wing politics. This document, though, and I could say more about it, of course, because it's the focal point of this particular piece, needs to be situated in a larger context. It's not just this document that indicates the CIA's concern with cultural warfare. On the contrary, there's a vast body of literature and internal documents that have been released concerning, in particular, an organization that existed from the mid-1940s to the mid-1960s called the Congress for Cultural Freedom, which was headquartered in Paris and was later discovered to be a CIA front organization. This organization is referred to in its workings with the CIA by well-known scholar Hugh Wilford as perhaps the largest patron of the arts and culture in the history of the world. So this was an enormous endeavor to promote American culture, American values, and here I put American in scare quotes. It's a very specific understanding of America. It's not the indigenous population, the black radical tradition, the radical ecological and feminist tradition, but instead a very specific understanding of America qua free enterprise, and that goes hand in hand with a very specific understanding of representational and not substantive democracy. So this particular document that was written in 1985 needs to be situated in this larger context in order to be made sense of, and also because this indicates that it's highly likely that there are other such documents. It's just that they have not yet been released through the Freedom of Information Act. What we discover in this document in particular, though, is a concern on the part of the CIA to read what many consider to be the most cutting-edge and complicated theoretical production, perhaps of the latter half of the 20th century. Figures like Jacques Lacan, Jacques Derrida, Michel Foucault, and many others. And what they were interested in is the ways in which the towering figures of the post-war French intelligentsia, in particular Jean-Paul Sartre, who was the founder of at least one of the major figures in existentialism, how there was a drift away from the hard Marxist and leftist positions of someone like Sartre or others such as Althusser, Colombart, toward these more centrist positions. And they clearly wanted to encourage this. We see this in the work of Thomas Braden, who was a CIA operative, who spoke about the CIA's cultural program, and he clearly stated that one of the ideological orientations of the CIA was to work directly with the non-communist left in order to sever it from the hard egalitarian left and to delegitimate the latter. And so there was a very specific understanding of this type of psychological warfare, where they wanted to divide the left and sever the revolutionary left in order to preserve a kind of reformist leftist position. Because ultimately they thought that they couldn't get rid of leftism entirely. In fact, one of the interesting elements in this document, which I would encourage all of your listeners to read, is that they clearly celebrate the return of right-wing politics that was the same right-wing politics that had been delegitimated in the Second World War, meaning a fascist-style, anti-egalitarian, brutally repressive, and authoritarian mode of politics. And so their concern was to divide the left, delegitimate the hard left, and any leftists who remain would be reformist leftists who could be recuperated within a certain consensual academic discourse.
There were quite a few pieces of cultural means in which the CIA seemed to engage in this. And you wrote about some of this in your piece, having offices in 35 countries, publishing dozens of prestige magazines, books, conferences, exhibits, performances, concerts. So the question is, how is it that these things, and one example that you pulled out was the Boston Symphony Orchestra, how is it that the Boston Symphony Orchestra can serve this part of the CIA and its interests in culture?
Well, Tom Braden, again, I think is very clear on this front. This is the CIA operative who says that the cultural warfare and the support of things like the Boston Symphony Orchestra won more people to the American cause of freedom of expression in some general sense than any politician ever would or ever could. What I take it that he means by this is that the promotion of a particular mode of culture and a set of values that go, or purportedly go hand in hand with that culture, is a way of indoctrinating people without them actually seeing the ideas seep into their minds. And so what the CIA was particularly, and arguably probably still is, interested in is promoting an image of the United States as being a free and open society in which any individual can express their views and everyone is accepting of everyone else's views. In that sense, they were struggling directly against the Soviet regime and the ways in which, due to the kind of evolution, particularly of the Stalinism in the Soviet Union, there were a number of artists who were censored, who fled, etc. And the CIA kept a very close watch on these individual artists and would often vacuum them up into their own modes of cultural promotion in order to basically communicate to the world, well, look, here, these artists aren't free in the communist world, but they are free in the world of America and in the West more broadly. And so they saw this as a way of communicating to the rest of the world a sense of freedom and autonomy that you could not get elsewhere. Now, what's interesting, of course, is the deep paradox that's operative here. If there was indeed simply a zone of free expression in which different forms of artistic and cultural production were valorized, then what are we to make of the fact that, in fact, this zone of free expression is actually undergirded by an entire matrix of dark money and manipulation? Because one of the things that I show in the article, and I do detail this as well, the article actually comes out of part of my book, Radical History and the Politics of Art, that came out a few years ago, is the extent to which the workings of the CIA were bound up with the private museum industry in primarily in New York, the Whitney Foundation, with the Rockefeller family. And these were people who were big players in power politics, as well as in the agenda of cultural warfare. And that what they promoted was a kind of form of, how to put it, a window display of freedom and autonomy, but a window display that had actually been structured by some of the most manipulative and conniving forces imaginable. And it's precisely that paradox that I think is quite interesting. How is it that you can actually have free expression if, in fact, free expression itself is something that is promoted for alternative ends often, and that actually is something that is culturally produced by a particular mechanism that wants to sell a specific product? And that product is the vision of America as a free and open society. What I should highlight is, of course, while the CIA was interested in this cultural warfare and invested very heavily in it, this is also an organization that, since its founding, has organized coup d'etat, assassination campaigns, a whole series of covert operations, in particular against governments that were democratically elected, but whose politics did not align on the agenda of the U.S. and the CIA's interests. So, on the one hand, you have the CIA cultural apparatus promoting freedom and autonomy ostensibly, while on the other hand, you have the dark tentacles of the CIA reaching around the world in order to overthrow the democratically elected government in Guatemala in 1954, Mossadegh in Iran, and elsewhere around the world in order to prop up governments that were perfectly in line with U.S. imperial interests. So in this sense, I think that it's quite an intricate story, but it situates the promotion of a particular type of freedom in relationship to a larger ideological war. And that ideological war is the promotion of American interests.
And in particular, certain arts and certain philosophies and not others.
Yes,
so
absolutely.
Why do you think there was a particular interest in reading the works of these French philosophers?
Well, I think one of the reasons is the prominence of the French intelligentsia on the world scene since World War II. Sartre was referred to as the total intellectual. He was known around the world, and his prominence arguably far surpassed many of the intellectuals prior to him or since him. He met with Castro, he traveled through Germany right after the Second World War, and the CIA identified him in particular as a very important target because of his explicit Marxism and his support not only of Marxism, but of anti-colonial struggles, of the women's movement, of basically progressive politics. And his prominence in France legitimated a particular orientation on the part of the intelligentsia towards a radical, transformative, egalitarian politics. And I believe the CIA saw that as a major threat to their mode of cultural warfare. This is particularly important because Sartre also helped found Libération, which was one of the major, and still is, newspapers that is left-leaning in France. And during the time that he served as the head of Libération, he revealed the dozens of CIA operatives, revealed the identities of them, who were working in France. So it's not only that he was doing intellectual work that they found dangerous, but actually his concrete political work was revealing the identities of agents who were working within France, including the head of the CIA in Paris.
The other piece of your article talked about in the United States, but talks right. about how the CIA helped to promote only certain types of academics and to sort of reshape the institution of academia. Can you shed light on that?
Well, the U.S. case is rather interesting, and there are other elements beyond what I actually have in the article that would need to be brought in particular because the CIA was mainly interested in global intellectual and cultural warfare. On the home front, it was primarily the FBI and then governmental organizations like HUAC. And one of the fascinating things about this history is that during the period of the Red Scare, one thing that you see very visibly within the U.S. Academy, particularly within the discipline of philosophy, is Red Witch Hunt, in which communists and strong leftists are chased out of the academy or seek exile in order to avoid that, and that a particular way of doing philosophy tends to be promoted, a type of philosophy that neither situates us in history, in a deep history, nor does it participate in social critique, but instead it's invested in a kind of, and there are various different forms of this, a description of everyday language, for instance, or a reliance on logic and mathematics, but in any case, a type of philosophy that is more oriented towards a kind of techno-scientific approach in which history and society are largely bracketed or left by the wayside in the name of the purported pursuit of truth in the present. This type of philosophy is non-threatening because the politics, if there are any that are explicitly stated, are certainly not in favor of any type of radical social transformation. The other type of politics, which is much more robustly dedicated to progressive causes, is inherently threatening. And you see this very clearly, for instance, around the case of the New Left and the status of Marcuse, who, of course, became one of the spokespeople for the New Left, coming out of the German Frankfurt School, and ran into a whole series of problems and complications for his publications, his political activism, etc. And so I think what you have, in short, is an international intellectual civil war of sorts in which there's an attempt to delegitimate hard leftism around the world. And on the home front, there's an attempt to purge it entirely so that the academy is no longer a site of radical contestation. And this goes, I think, hand in hand with other particular intellectual trends in which the intelligentsia is encouraged to focus on problems that are not directly related to radical social transformation.
You mentioned also this vocationalization of higher education. And I think this goes hand in hand with what you're talking about. It's not just the emphasis on one type of philosophy, but it's also about transforming the higher education institution into something that serves particular interests. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that one of the things that this piece is trying to really emphasize is the extent to which the world of ideas is materially conditioned, produced, and manipulated in various ways that we need to be attentive to. And one of those ways is through an institutional set of power relations that promote or render possible certain types of ideas, certain platforms, and renders impossible other ideas or platforms, or if not impossible, at least marginalizes them to such an extent that they're not actually part of mainstream discussions. One aspect of that is the vocationalization of higher education, turning higher education into, if it hasn't already been to a very large extent, a way of formatting citizens into cogs for the capitalist machinery, so that the goal of education would be an output from the university that would perfectly correspond to the needs of industry. In this sense, the focus is really on a kind of techno-scientific skill set that would allow one to be seamlessly integrated into the job market. Instead of, for instance, a notion of education in which, and here I'm thinking of the work of Cornelius Castoriadis or others who insist on education in the kind of ancient Greek sense of the term paideia, which was a collective way of forging together a common world in which education is actually a project of collectively forging citizens, not simply producing cogs in the capitalist apparatus. In that sense, this vocationalization of higher education is one way in which institutions of higher education are in many ways doing some of the work that the CIA, HUAC, the FBI, and other agencies were interested in promoting, but they're doing it on their own because there's less space in the academy for certain types of work to be done. And this goes hand in hand with the precarization of higher education, so that people are not given things like tenure or a certain amount of job security, but there's instead an adjunctification of higher education so that you have more and more people who are working in the capacity of adjunct labor, who can easily be fired, whose entire publication record, what they teach, what they say in public, all of that can be something that they are held accountable for. And so in this sense, the politics become extremely palpable because you have a kind of internal censoring that goes on. What the non-left-wing mass media calls the left is not the left. It's the center. I think it's extremely important that we redefine what the left really means. And the left means critique. It means material and systemic analysis. And it means not succumbing to the ideological games that are played by the conservatives.
Thank you so much for being with us here, Gabriel Rockhill.
Thank you.
Gabriel Rockhill, he's a professor of philosophy and political theory at Villanova University and directs the critical theory workshop at Sorbonne. His recent books include Counterhistory of the Present, Interventions in Contemporary Thought, and Radical History in the Politics of Art. When we come back, what is the code economy and what does it have to do with the future of work? Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Some people argue that machines are taking over human jobs, but our next guest argues that perhaps humanity will reinvent work in a way that's more aligned with what it means to be human. Philip Arswald is a professor of policy and government at the George Mason University. He's the editor of Iraq, 1990 to 2006, A Diplomatic History Through Documents. And he's also the author of The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy, and most recently, The Code Economy, A 40,000-Year History. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have you here with us.
Great to be here.
Maybe we should just begin with the title, The Code Economy. How are you defining code?
I use code here in a different way than the word might most immediately be understood by readers or listeners. So we might think about digital code as a sort of the default if we're thinking about, say, employment, which is a theme in the book. And I certainly talk a lot about the development of digital code. We can also think about codes of conduct, building codes, all sorts of other ways that we might use the word code just sort of in discussion. Actually, the version that applies most directly to the themes of the book is genetic code. And I'm really thinking about what is the genetic code of the economy. So in a way, the story that I want to tell is the genetic code of the economy is really the way that we produce things, the sort of recipe for producing things. That evolution of the recipe for producing things from, you know, I talk about 40,000 years, actually goes back earlier to the present, is a way of understanding the economy over the very long term.
When you talk about recipes, you talk about, you know, DNA code. So are we really just talking about any kind of organized information, sort of instructional information?
Yeah, I mean,
because DNA, when you stop and think about DNA, it's really information that tells our body how to function, for example.
Right. It's instructions to produce something. So when we think about economics, economics by and large has been a story of the what of production, outputs and things and prices and exchange and trade. And it's all about the things that we see in the world. But there's no product without process. This would be one of the ways I've tried to approach this in the book. So the evolution of products has in the background the evolution of products. And we can think about that like very directly in terms of culinary history. So people have been consuming meals and sharing meals and generally subsisting by eating for as long as we've been people. For a very long time, the recipes that were used to prepare food were extremely rudimentary. They might have just involved sort of smashing or slicing even before there was cooking. But it turns out that those rudimentary recipes were actually essential to the evolution of the human species. That when we began to, in some ways, externalize the functions of our digestive system, that by cutting and smashing, say, tubers or meats, we allowed some of the work that the digestive system would have had to do on its own to be done by tools. And so that really freed up our body from this sort of focus on digestion and allowed us to grow larger brains, which made us the species that we are. But that began with a process. So we sort of care less in some ways retrospectively about what we ate. That was important, but it was learning how to employ a structured process to turn an input into an output. And of course, you know, move that forward to all the culinary diversity that we have in the world today, which is not really a greater diversity of ingredients. Actually, we use fewer ingredients now in cooking than we did, say, 200 or 300 years ago as a consequence of monoculture and this sort of convergence of the food system on a few default food inputs, a few being a few thousand. But we have this incredible variety of recipes, this almost never-ending, you know, sort of increase in culinary diversity. And that's just thinking about food. But of course, it's mirrored in every other aspect of the economy.
We'll want to take a few more examples, of course, but I thought what we would move to here is how you argued that as these things become more complex, that we change. And one of the examples, you talked about memory capacity.
So memory capacity is interesting because we get fairly directly, when we think about short-term memory, into a comparison with digital computers or computing machines, generally speaking. We've just been talking about recipes and culinary innovation. The capacity of machines to do work for people, of which this sort of early cooking is an example, but it's also importantly exemplified by algorithms and digital computers and what they accomplish. Actually, part of the way I got to doing a 40,000-year history in this book was I was starting with kind of contemporary debates about robots are taking our jobs. And in fact, it was just a recent important paper by Darren Acemoglu and the co-author at MIT that just came out yesterday that's sort of further to this theme. But there's just a lot of important research being done now on the extent to which automation or particularly robots in this case are displacing human work. But it turns out that these discussions were occurring at almost the same level of intensity in the early 1960s. There were presidential commissions and the great Herbert Simon, Nobel laureate, and also a Turing Award winner, wrote about this extensively in the 1960s and even as early as the 1950s. And then we kind of go back further to the 1920s, where it wasn't about computing so much as it was about automation, white-collar work, and you had the sort of Burroughs computing machine, Burroughs adding machine, which transformed office work, among other. And in any event, this sort of narrative about human and machine work goes back 200 or 300 years. In fact, it was Gottfried Leibniz in 1666 that first developed the idea behind the digital computer. So we've been having this discussion for a very long time. And it turns out that at every stage that we've had, you know, this, what I call the advance of code, but basically the advance of this frontier of recipes or of the how of production, at every stage that that's happened, it's prompted a fundamental rethink of what human beings do and really what human beings are. And we're at one of those junctures now. So it is actually a very exciting time at the same time that it's threatening. But this is not at all exceptional. This is another phase of this evolution of humanity interacting with code over a very, very long time period.
It sounds like there's this dynamic between, you know, what you aptly point out is the idea that then turns into the technology and the organization around that, the code and all of this. But then that in turn changes us.
Well, technology is an interesting word, actually. When we think about technology, we tend to think about gizmos. But technology is a combination of techne, which is Greek for art, craft, or trade, and logos, which can be translated as an ordered account. So you think about an ordered account of art, craft, or trade, it's instructions, it's algorithms, it's recipes, it's code. So technology, recipes, and code are almost interchangeable. And so this notion of our interacting with technology isn't about our interaction with gizmos. It's actually our interaction with instructions for doing things. And it's so fundamental to how we live and what we do that we have repeatable instructions, right? Whether it's in our own practices or certainly in organizations, and how when we interact with those routines or instructions, it defines what we are as people. It's so ingrained in what we are that we kind of forget that it's even there.
And the idea that this is in some way affecting human evolution is one of the things I thought was interesting. Is there a way you can help us to see the evolutionary process here?
I'm an economist by training, and so my way into this topic was really by thinking about how economists have represented the evolution of human societies. And I was inspired by, among other people, Sidney Winter, with whom I've had some recent interactions about the book, and it's been great to discuss it with him. But Sidney Winter's work is exceptional in that it actually addresses evolution, and most economics doesn't. So we're not in a great position as economists to talk about evolution. So that's just a sort of a caveat there. But in researching the book and thinking about it, I really do feel like there's a deep evolutionary story that where code is not just by way of sort of metaphor, but actually is literally the DNA of the economy, and where the evolution of code over time is an evolutionary process that is amenable to study using the tools and techniques of biological evolution. So I actually do believe this is a literal evolutionary process. The real question comes basically between the people who make a case that it sounds like I'm making sort of by default, which is that we've been through this before and we know how it turns out. And essentially human capabilities, human opportunities, and the well-being of people in society has always increased. So there's no reason to be concerned that now that we're reaching the sort of next frontier in the advance of code. And then different, comparably well-informed people who say, you know, this is different. This is just simply not like the agricultural to manufacturing transition or the previous transitions to mechanization and manufacturing, that digital computation and artificial intelligence just are a completely different phenomenon. And so I do feel like this is an evolutionary process. I do feel like we're at the next stage. And I do have my own viewpoint as to, you know, what is likely to happen. But it's most important to say that it's an extremely significant and important question that we should all be concerned about, and that the answer is not at all obvious either way, whether it's doom or salvation.
Well, let's dig into some of the work examples that you gave in that section about the economy. And one of the cliches that you mentioned in there in the tech world was that if you're not paying for a service, you are the product. And then you examine the U.S. healthcare system in this context. How does this fit in with the code economy, this healthcare, the village model, the wearables?
So that fits in a couple of ways. I mean, just practically speaking, if we look at the very recent evolution of the U.S. economy, what I have elsewhere talked about is distributed health services. And I just use that term because we don't really have a good term for a combination of peer-to-peer sort of neighbors helping neighbors type health services, which is actually an important and growing area, medical health calls, mobile, telehealth, via computer sort of thing. So there's a whole array of health service options and healthcare options that aren't about hospitals and they're not about outpatient. So that whole domain has been among the fastest growing domains of job creation, particularly sort of middle class, middle wage job creation in the U.S. economy. So post 2008, 3 out of 10 of the fastest growing job categories in the United States were in some version of distributed health services that I've just defined it. And a number of the others were in energy, and those turned out to be a bubble. So when we think about where jobs are actually being created, they are being created in peer-to-peer health services and distributed health services, and that is only going to grow. So that's one area of the U.S. economy, of European economies, of the Chinese economy, where I think we're likely to see very, very significant growth. But why is that? You know, a phrase that I haven't, that I didn't use in the book, but actually I feel like in some ways sums up a core ideas in the book, is that eye contact can't be automated. And there is a element of just being with other human beings that we don't even fully understand what it means. We communicate with each other in ways that are not fully grasped scientifically, but have been, you know, sort of explored on the margins in mysticism, but even in cognitive psychology, some sort of notions of how people communicate with one another in terms of, basically, some forms of nonverbal communication that we clearly have with each other. And so we're going to have to be exploring these, because it's those dimensions of non-literal communication that really are human-to-human comparative advantage. And when you're caring for other people, when people are vulnerable and sick, all of those dimensions of feeling are extremely important. Now, they may have been sort of driven out of at least some dimensions of our healthcare system. It may not be at the center of it, but I think they're going to come back, because the technical elements of healthcare are going to be managed very well by artificial intelligence and by data analytics and by diagnostics in the cloud and all of this sort of new generation of health services that are coming online. So healthcare is important in and of itself, because it's an area of very significant job growth just right now, but it's also important because it draws our attention to this notion of eye contact being something that we really cannot easily imagine being automated. And that's important. And it may actually turn out to be very important to wellness outcomes, just simply that people can connect with other people.
So that becomes a value that can only be provided by a human being as opposed to a machine.
Exactly. And then somebody, you know, listening may say, well, you know, that's not true. We can imagine a replication of an eyeball, and there's no reason to think that you can't design a robot so that when you look into its eyes, that you can fall in love with it. That's fine. If you want to believe that, that's fine. I just don't personally believe that. And I don't believe it because of what I was just saying about what we don't understand about what it is to be with other people. And so I don't think that we can recreate something that we as a species haven't even fully comprehended yet. But that's the domain that we're going to be entering into, is this domain of real personal connection. And that's where people add value, because it's not going to be doing mechanized things, and it's not going to be doing routine things. Those jobs, those tasks, are simply not going to be well performed by people as opposed to algorithms.
And they made that movie about the guy who fell in love with his operating system. And it was something that you really had to stop and think about, in terms of it had the algorithms that kept making it increasingly human and increasingly fit for him, and whether or not that's even an option.
It's very provocative. And I think the themes in popular culture have gone well beyond, I think, where the public policy discussion is. The public policy discussion is still talking about whether or not we have net job destruction as opposed to automation. We have our current Secretary of Commerce saying that this is 100 years off, and we have the MIT economist saying that we already have large-scale job displacement as a consequence of increased deployment of robots, this particularly manufacturing robots. You know, that's where the public policy discussion is. In the popular culture, it's gone way past that, and it goes to where I feel like the real discussion is, and what I try to talk about in this book, which is that if robots are taking our jobs, then what's left for humans to do? Well, what's left for humans to do is to be human. That's what we do better than robots. Okay, so then what does that mean? See, that's an interesting question. What does it mean to be human? This is an interesting question. People have been thinking about this for a very long time. And it turns out that this is integrally linked to the way we organize our days, the way we organize our society, which is based on code, as I'm describing it broadly. So there is this interaction between this question of what it is to be human and the advance of code. And that's the frontier. It's not some technical question as to which jobs are or aren't being created, or even what a job means, which is another thing I talk about in the book.
Right. So you're also talking about cultural code, really.
Right. So what culture is, as opposed to code, is something that I actually don't really get into in the book, because it's almost like a different dimension of the question. People are maybe familiar with the notion of memes, and it may sound like what I'm talking about in terms of code is like a cultural meme. But the difference is that a meme is not a productive activity. A meme is not a recipe. And so if you think about the code, as I'm describing it, as recipes, and where does that fit in with culture? Think about code as the instructions to prepare a specific meal. So it could be like somebody's specific ramen recipe. And this is just like, this is the broth, and this is how I'm bringing everything together, and this is my amazing ramen that I make. Culture is about how meals are eating, how people customarily consume. Do we sit together? Do we sit separately? What are the utensils that are used? What is the usual interval for a meal? Are we on the floor? Are we at a table? Are we standing? What is a meal? That's culture. And of course, culture affects recipes, because people will design recipes to fit within the culture. But the way that people consume meals changes much more slowly than recipes themselves. The way in which people consume meals does change, and it changes over time. Those are changes in cultures, like the notion of TV dinner. You can't have a TV dinner if you don't have a TV. So that whole notion of people eating a meal in front of a television did not exist in 1920 for obvious reasons. So there is an evolution of the culture of eating. That's not what this book is about. This book is about the code that underlies that. And again, there are biological examples, and we can think about what's slow changing, what's fast changing. But I think what hasn't really been described in economics adequately is what sits between culture and individual choice, and that's code. We've got a lot of economics about individual choice, and we have a lot of sociology about culture. But in the middle of that is code. And it's my view, and Sidney Winter's, and Herbert Simon's, and any number of actually, you know, eminent thinkers, Herbert Spencer, who wrote about something very similar. He's the person who coined the term survival of the fittest and was a contemporary of Darwin's. He wrote essentially about code as well. It's a theme in economics and in social science that goes back centuries. What I tried to do in this book is just bring it together in one place, because that, just surprisingly to me, and also to Sid Winter, hadn't been done.
It's actually a little bit difficult to separate out exactly how distinct what you're calling code is from, you know, norms in society, because those could be considered code. They, you know, these are sort of the DNA of a society or a group of people. And so this is the difficult part in separating what you mean by code.
Yeah. I can see that. I mean, for me, I really think about it as like a production algorithm. And so a norm doesn't have an input and an output. There's no how of doing something. So this is not like very, at the level of code, it's just not mystical. I mean, think about, like, I start by talking about a chocolate chip cookie recipe. I actually tell the story of Ruth Wakefield, who was the proprietress with her husband of the Toll House, in which the Toll House cookie, the chocolate chip cookie, was first invented. And so, and I use at the beginning of the book the actual recipe from the Toll House cookie, or from the Nestle the semi-sweet chocolate bag, where anybody can see this recipe. But anyway, the point is there's inputs and there's outputs. There's the ingredients that you're going to bring together, what you need to make the cookies, and then there's the number of cookies you can make, like 24 or whatever. What matters is the instructions, is how you make the cookies. And that's what I'm talking about. So a cultural norm is not a recipe. You can't make anything with it. Whereas if you think about the iPhone, there is a process, there is a recipe, and you can actually enumerate, there's all the subcontractors and there's all the things they do, and then there's all the raw materials. I mean, it's a very complex recipe. It's much more complex than the recipe for chocolate chip cookies. But there are people doing very specific and actually routine things some of which can be written down in either a patent or an instruction manual, and some of which may be hard, they may not have been fully aware of, just as in a kitchen, there's things that a cook isn't fully aware of that they just do. But there is a process, there is a recipe for creating an iPhone, and there is a recipe for creating a skyscraper. There is a recipe for creating anything that we see in the world. That's what I'm talking about in terms of code. And it sits at a level kind of below what we think about as cultural norms, or these very slowly changing kind of maybe governing things that may determine which codes survive and which don't, but it's not code itself. So to me, it's pretty clear, but maybe it's not to your listeners or to you.
Thank you for that distinction, because I think that allows us to then distinguish out the other aspects that you were trying to point out in the book, which is, you know, there is code and then there is something else that is human. And some of that you say is morality, which, you know, sociologists would say, well, that's socially constructed as well. So maybe it's linked to code.
Right.
And identity and all of these other aspects of what it is to be human. And so now when you're talking about the economy, of course, and you're talking about where we're going and peer-to-peer being one of the places and what it is we're going to value in the future of work and what it means to work and redefining work itself, let's go to some of these things. What are these human elements that are separate that you see as the future?
I may get some eye rolls from this from maybe you or, you know, folks listening, but I actually mean it quite seriously. And so, like, bear me out before you decide that, you know, I'm just making this up. But Burning Man. So the Burning Man so-called festival that I have only been to twice, you know, there are many people who've been, you know, sort of every time, or and it's really built into their whole experience of life at this point. But it really was a fascinating experience for me, because it is a movement, and it's one that's sort of prototyping a mode of social and economic engagement, a set of values applied. And I actually have the Burning Man principles, so you can just Google Burning Man principles and you can see what they are. I just reprint them in the book. But they're really a set of values and organizing principles, like a blueprint for a society, for a new way of thinking about society. It's demonetized, but the fact that it's demonetized, to me, it's not just sort of a reflexive sort of anti-materialism or anti-capitalism. It's not an anti-something. It's a constructive set of rules that evolved from the practices of this community. There is a culture. There are rules. There's norms. There's a morality. But the morality is based on the immediacy of human experience. It's exactly what we were talking about in terms of, you know, eye contact can't be automated. I mean, some ways of thinking about the experience of being in Burning Man that led me to sort of saying, I think that's what I'm trying to say with this book. So I think people who have been to Burning Man and had the experience that I did of being there, it's just a discontinuity from what, you know, Berners call the default world. It is a discontinuous type experience. You know, another thing that it is that's very important for Burning Man and for my book is it's a city. It's a temporary city. And cities, you know, and I'm certainly not the first person to say this, Ed Glaser at Harvard wrote a tremendous book called The Triumph of the City and really made this point, you know, just beautifully. But cities are pretty much without question humanity's greatest inventions. We take cities for granted, but the fact that cities exist and do what they do is of tremendous importance. And the fact that this mode of experience that likely will become more and more dominant, I think it almost inevitably has to become more and more dominant, has been prototyped within a temporary city, to me, seems exactly fitting and exactly right. Because cities will have to function more like Burning Man, or I don't think that we're going to have viable human societies, which I do think we're going to have. So I'm not worried about that. I think you're right, that in some ways, the Burning Man principles are a code, but they're a code for designing. The input is people and the output's a city. I mean, it's a very meta code.
You're saying also that in the future, the platforms that are going to be successful and the models that are going to be successful are going to have some aspect of this, rewarding peers, but also you talked a bit about authentication, verification, and this other undefinable human thing.
Well, right now, you talk about Uber, you can talk about the aggregation of data by Google and Facebook, you know, the dominance of platforms, and even if they're providing services for free, you know, just as you were sort of quoting earlier, this notion of, well, we're really the product because our data is being aggregated and all that. So, I mean, these are all very real issues. There's no question that the way in which platforms are being built now on top of platforms and on top of platforms, and that's a different story, but the way in which the sort of top-level platforms are being built now concentrates wealth in the owners of the platforms. It doesn't mean that it doesn't create all sorts of wonderful things. Google does create all sorts of wonderful things for all of us, but there is a wealth concentration that occurs just as the nature of the sort of function of the platform. So I do think that some version of the blockchain, and so for people who aren't familiar with the blockchain or haven't been reading digital trade press about how the blockchain is the future, essentially the blockchain is the internet for transactions. And so it was great to have an internet for information. The internet for information has been unbelievable, but it's not optimized for transactions. And so you think about, you know, how a Wikipedia basically was the end of Encyclopedia Britannica. That was in information. Encyclopedia Britannica had the job of authenticating what was a true statement about any topic. And then you would go to Encyclopedia Britannica and it would tell you because they had validated that statement. Now, we don't need Encyclopedia Britannica to do that. We do it for each other. It's a group of 200 people at Wikipedia, actually only 40 of whom are community managers, that manage resources that gets to 350 million page views a day. So it's a tremendously powerful and distributed system. Now, imagine if you have the same thing, that instead of it being Encyclopedia Britannica validating an entry, you have Bank of America validating a transaction. We don't know that the transaction is not really legitimate until Bank of America tells us it is. Well, if you have a blockchain, if you can have a transaction validated on a peer-to-peer basis, you don't need Bank of America as an intermediary any more than you needed Encyclopedia Britannica. So whether you call it the blockchain or whether you don't, or what specifically the platform is, or whether, you know, it evolves or not from where we are, something like that almost inevitably will happen, I believe. And it's going to be tremendously powerful, because what it does is, in the same way that Wikipedia distributes authority to the edges, where anybody can be an author and anyone can be an authority, but it's the power of essentially the crowd of the city, of the global city of Wikipedia, that disciplines the resource so it actually is true. That's what blockchain can do for transactions. And it's very, very difficult to imagine how fundamentally that will restructure economics and society.
You know, it's interesting because we're simultaneously in an age of fake news in which people do not really know what to trust information-wise, despite that there is checking in a community on a particular site, which still gets its facts wrong frequently. And I wonder how that ends up affecting where we go from here.
Well, I mean, if we go down the rabbit hole of fake news, then I think, you know, it's a great point, because it's essentially, you know, we're in this transitional period, right? By the way, I love the New York Times. I'm a subscriber of the New York Times. I believe in this notion of a newspaper of record has been extremely important. I think right now, our newspapers and sources of record are important, and I support them. However, in the story I was just telling, the function of a newspaper of record becomes less important. And so the problem is, in this transitional phase, you have a lot of disorder. Just like in the transitional phase toward blockchain, you have the aggregation of data by a Google or a Facebook, and it concentrates wealth. So what we have is, we have this sort of like partial dismantling of what was the previous sort of structure of authentication and verification, but it's not a total dismantling. So something like, and I'll just call it out, Breitbart or whatever, can step in and do something that looks the same, but actually isn't the same. So, and part of that is about culture and norms and basically processes that validate, where Wikipedians, this is not a made up community of people. It's a community. There are values. They have meetings. They have conferences. They build this community. The community then disciplines what happens in the community. It doesn't just magically happen. People don't just magically type stuff in Wikipedia. There are 70,000 regular contributors to Wikipedia who make that community what it is. Burning Man doesn't just happen. They don't just pop up. There are people who know what the ethic is, who understand the values of Burning Man, and who make that what it is. So in this new world of our creating and validating even news for each other, we need to evolve a culture so that that's done, so that what we read is true. And that's on everybody. It's not just on the New York Times. It's on everybody. And we're not there yet. So it's a big challenge. But nobody said it was going to be easy.
So your argument at the very end of the book is about redefining our identity. And you argue that we're built to produce, like that is who we are, and that we're essentially developing and advancing code, that that's who we are as humans and as our labor identity. But then you also touched on one other thing, and that had to do with some things that Rousseau had said back in the day that he was alive about, you know, being born free and yet everywhere now man lives in chains. It sounds like your argument is those chains are actually a good thing.
That's always been one of my favorite quotes in political philosophy. You know, man is born free and everywhere he's in chains. And you think about that and, you know, we sort of reflexively go back to sort of Noble Savage and how is it that in this condition, you know, we began in this condition of genuine freedom and this idealized sort of existence that as Rousseau paints it, and then we have all these obligations. But the fact of the matter is that these obligations are understandings and codified in some ways, reciprocity, but otherwise just understandings of collaboration, of sharing, of understanding, of recognition, of seeing somebody, that I know who you are and I recognize your face. That's a connection. That's a form of, you can call it a chain or a link. It's a tie. But when we have these connections, you know, when you have a connection within a family, it's quite obvious that that's constraining at the same time that it's liberating. When you live in a city, you depend on other people for your survival. That's constraining, you know, in the sense that if they don't provide me with what I need to survive, it's troublesome. On the other hand, you know, it's liberating because we can do things in cities that we never really could do if when we were just scavengers and hunters and gatherers. So that is really the point. And that when we think about what we evolve as people, the primary thing that we've evolved as people are practices to create. And that's the human legacy, more than institutions, more than even the United States Constitution, is subsidiary to this sort of broader category. And if there's any confusion about any of this, we can only think about culinary recipes that are preparing meals for each other, are having experiences with each other, is still at the core of the human experience. It was around the campfire, you know, 500,000 years ago, and it's still today. We have our festivals, our religious festivals, and our familial festivals, and everything that brings us together to share food. That is really what the human experience is about, and it works because we are tied to each other. And that's liberating. It's not ultimately constraining.
Philip Arswald, it is a joy to host you. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed the discussion.
Philip Arswald is a professor of policy and government at the George Mason University. He's the editor of Iraq, 1990 to 2006, A Diplomatic History Through Documents. And he's also the author of The Coming Prosperity, How Entrepreneurs Are Transforming the Global Economy, and most recently, The Code Economy, A 40,000-Year History. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.